The CEM Network is pleased to present Ronald L. Dart and Born to Win.
Someone observed not long ago that the last redoubt of Marxism in the world was on the campuses of elite American universities. Actually, the statement wasn't a surprise, really, but it did make me start thinking about how it could possibly be so. After all, Marxism and communism together represent two of the greatest failures in economic and political thought in the history of man. From a time when many people thought they had the answers, they really thought the communism had the answers, that communism was the wave of the future. We have lived to see the Soviet Union collapse, Marxism utterly discredited as an economic system, and I think we're not very far from witnessing the failure of China's communist regime. That eventuality has some economists worried about the disaster that would wreak on the already weakened world economy. Communism has worked nowhere. Not really. And it has led to some of the most egregious abuses of power in the experience of man, to the cruelest destruction of life and liberty. Only after the fall of the Soviet Union did we really get to see what had been done there. So why, I wondered, should some of the smartest, best educated among us still cling to something that looks very much like Marxism and communism? Some time ago, a friend sent me a book by Whitaker Chambers titled Witness. You may have read it, may have heard of it. I had heard of Chambers and Alger Hiss back in my youth, but I paid little attention. Chambers was just finishing the book Witness as I was a senior in high school. I'd heard of Chambers and Alger Hiss back in my youth, but I didn't pay much attention to that. Chambers was just finishing Witness when I was majoring in girls, not politics. The book is daunting, to say the least. It weighs in at 800 pages, so it sat on my desk for months after a friend had sent it to me, until guilt finally made me pick it up and begin to read. I strongly recommend it to you. If nothing else, drop by your library and read the forewords. There are three of them. The first by William Buckley, the second by Robert Novak, the third is Whitaker Chambers' Letter to His Children. It is not so much in reading it that I learned a lot of great new truths. What it did was shine a light on a subject that lit up areas I really had not thought about. I want to talk to you about it, but first I need to answer the question I raised. How is it possible that Marxism still holds sway among so many in the intelligentsia of this nation? The answer emerged for me as I read Chambers' Letter to His Kids. Communism and Marxism, along with Nazism, were merely masks worn by a much greater and much older evil, which persist in spite of the failure of the one of the masks that we have seen. I'm reluctant to put a name on it, because we have a bad habit of assuming that when we can name something, we understand it. Not so. Names are treacherous things, and we quickly become inured to them. Liberalism, capitalism, progressivism, conservatism. Names are like chameleons, and they take on the coloring of the background, and we can look right at them and not see them. Liberals became tired of people bandying around their terminology, and it almost became the L word among some people. They decided they were not liberals anymore. They were progressives. Republicans are becoming conservative. That's where the votes are. Capitalists are becoming entrepreneurs because the communists beat up capitalism so bad. Secularists are becoming progressive, too. I'm not going to give you a name for this evil. I'm going to hand you a key that will open your eyes to recognize it in its earliest forms wherever it emerges in the political, economic, and social systems of an age. I need also to point out there are two kinds of evil in the world, at least. There is human evil and spiritual evil. For some reasons, people are prone to deny both of these. Human evil they see as perhaps mental illness. Spiritual evil they sometimes deny by rejecting the idea of a personal devil and demons as mere figures of speech in the Bible, standing for the wicked inclinations of our own mind. But for now, I want to return to my question. How is it possible that Marxism, or something very much like it, still holds sway among the intelligentsia of this nation? In reading Whitaker Chambers' letter to his children, I came to at least a partial answer. In some degree, it is revealed in the experiences of ex-communists, defectors from the communist system. Chambers wrote to his kids, "Yet there is one experience which most sincere ex-communists share. The daughter of a former German diplomat in Moscow was trying to explain to me why her father, who, as an enlightened modern man, had been extremely pro-communist, had become an implacable anti-communist. It was hard for her because, as an enlightened modern girl, she shared the communist vision without being a communist. But she loved her father, and the irrationality of his defection embarrassed her." He quotes her. "He was immensely pro-Soviet," she said. "And then you will laugh at me, but you must not laugh at my father." And then, one night in Moscow, he heard screams. That's all. Simply one night, he heard screams. Whitaker Chambers was himself an ex-communist, and so he went on after citing what this girl said. What communist has not heard those screams? They come from husbands torn forever from their wives in a midnight arrest. They come muffled from the execution chambers of the secret police, from the torture chambers of the Lubyanka, from all the citadels of terror now stretching from Berlin to Canton. They come from freight cars loaded with men, women, and children, the enemies of the communist state, locked in, packed in, left on remote sidings to freeze to death at night in the Russian winter. They come from minds driven mad by the horrors of mass starvation, ordered and enforced as a policy of the communist state. They come from the starved skeletons worked to death or flogged to death, as an example to others, in the freezing filth of subarctic labor camps. They come from the children whose parents are suddenly inexplicably taken away from them, parents they will never see again. As I read that, it was the image of the freight cars that hit me. For a moment, I felt confused. I thought, wait, am I reading about the Holocaust, about Nazi Germany and the things they did? No, I'm reading about the Soviet Union. They did the same thing. They took innocent people. For whatever reason, they took whole families, men, women, and children, threw them into a boxcar, crammed them in there like cordwood, and shoved it out on a siding for them to freeze to death in the Russian winter. And in point of fact, the evil of communism and Nazism is pretty much the same at the core. They are two different faces of the same evil. The communists and the Nazis hated each other, to be sure, not because they were different, but they were rivals for the same wicked vision. Chambers went on, "What communist has not heard those screams? Execution, says the communist code, is the highest measure of social protection. What man can call himself a communist who has not accepted the fact that terror is an instrument of policy, right if the vision is right, justified by history, enjoined by the balance of forces in the social wars of this century? Those screams have reached every communist's mind. Usually, they stop there." End quote. I read that, and I thought, terror as an instrument of policy? This is being practiced today in Iran and other places in the world. Nowadays, it seems to be what all it's in the news is jihadism. And what they are doing is on a very much smaller scale so far from anything like the communists or the Nazis did in their day. Terror as an instrument of policy. You know, it's hard for me to see Islam as God-denying, because one of the points that Chambers makes is that this whole communist idea is God-denying. But I wonder if perhaps there is a part of Islam that does indeed deny God. Have you ever noticed the puzzlement of people who can't figure out why our administration rejects the expression war on terror? Stay with me through this short break. When I come back, I'll explain.
God didn't make man evil, so why is there so much evil in the world? For a free introductory CD in the series titled Origins of Evil, write to Born to Win, Post Office Box 560, White House, Texas 75791. Or call toll-free 1-888-BIBLE-44. That's 1-888-242-5344.
Nowadays, when there is so much focus testing of words and expressions and so forth, people are always changing the words on us so that we don't necessarily know what in the world they're talking about, or they want to be sure that we look at it the way they want us to look at it. But I remember wondering, what on earth is the big deal? George Bush called it the war on terror. The Obama administration got rid of that. They didn't much like even talking about it as terrorism as such. They keep being reluctant, it seems, to identify it as such. In fact, one administration official, I think, called it a man-caused disaster or something like that. Well, Chambers, writing before the principal figures in the present administration were even born, talked about it this way. What man can call himself a communist who has not accepted the fact that terror is an instrument of policy? Right if the vision is right, justified by history, enjoined by the balance of forces in the social wars of this century. You know, it's a mistake to call anyone a communist today. Communism failed. Communism was destroyed. Marxism was left with its pants around its ankles. When you say that someone is a communist, you discredit yourself in the eyes of the onlooker. Communism was, in any case, only a mask for a mind that says your policy is right if the vision is right, justified by history, enjoined by the balance of forces. It does seem, for some reason, the Obama administration does not want to call what they are doing a war on terror, because they know that terrorism is a principle accepted by many people as fully justified as an instrument of policy. And it's as though it's a part of the foreign policy as to how we try to work with this. It's a matter of civil disobedience. It's a matter of a crime to be punished in court like any other criminal, like a burglar or a murderer. Well, communism, as I said, is only a mask for the mind that says your policy is right if the vision is right, justified by history, enjoined by the balance of forces. And in this simple idea, you get one of the first hints of the evil that was behind the mask of communism, Nazism, and maybe even jihadism. It is this: the pervasive idea that our goals are so noble, so vital, our vision so right, that whatever we have to do to reach those goals is justified. On that little academic statement there, the foundation is laid for what eventually winds up of sticking a boxcar full of men, women, and children on a siding in the Russian winter to freeze to death. The old saw, the ends justify the means, seems so tame. It doesn't even come close to describing the evil behind the mask. The ends don't justify the means. But even here, we have not really yet arrived at the first signs of incipient evil, not to the key that helps us understand it or of the cause that lies behind it. Whitaker Chambers defined the key that unlocked his understanding, and it's a remarkable statement in his letter to his children. He said, "My break began long before I heard those screams. Perhaps it does for everyone. I do not know how far back it began, but I date my break from a very casual happening. I was sitting in our apartment on St. Paul Street in Baltimore. My daughter was in her high chair. I was watching her eat. She was the most miraculous thing that had ever happened in my life. I liked to watch her even when she smeared porridge on her face or dropped it meditatively on the floor. My eye came to rest on the delicate convolutions of her ear. Those intricate, perfect ears. The thought passed through my mind. No, these ears were not created by any chance coming together of atoms in nature, the communist view. They could have been created only by immense design. The thought was involuntary and unwanted. I crowded it out of my mind, but I never wholly forgot it or the occasion. I had to crowd it out of my mind. If I had completed it, I should have had to say, "Design presupposes God." I did not even then know that at that moment the finger of God was first laid upon my forehead. I sensed something there that Chambers did not mention. You could have sat with him and argued intelligent design for hours and hours and made no progress. And staring at any other kid's ear would not have done it. It was the love for his daughter that opened this door, that laid the hand of God on his forehead. It was love that did it. Isn't that a wild idea? It was love that was the key that unlocked the chains that held him. One of the more striking things I learned about the Nazis when I'm reading about them is the great evil that they perpetrated, but the banality of the men who did these things. There was no passion. There was nothing at all like that. They were just banal in all that they did. Oh, they could be angry, but their passion was loveless. They were men who could only be passionate about ideas they could not love. This book was written back in 1952. Barack Obama was born in 1961. Why do I mention that? The first introduction to the book Witness was written by William F. Buckley. He wrote, had a lot to say about the man, but when he learned that Chambers had died, Buckley sat down and wept. He wrote, quote, "Chambers had written me once, 'American men who weep in droves in the movie houses over the woes of love-struck girls hold that weeping in men is unmanly. I have found most men in whom there was a depth of experience or capacity for compassion singularly apt to tears.'" End quote. And without willing it, I saw in my mind's eye George Bush moved to tears, losing his composure. And I suddenly realized that so far, I have seen nothing like that anywhere in the current administration. No passion, except perhaps in anger. But in trying to find the key to recognizing the evil, the absence of love may not be so easily spotted by us standing out here in nowhere's land. There is, though, a point where you can see it, where you will even experience it. That point will always arrive at first in small ways, growing into something more sinister. Chambers again reveals how it came to him. Quote, "One thing most communists could agree upon, they broke because they wanted to be free. They do not all mean the same thing by free. Freedom is a need of the soul and nothing else. It is in striving toward God that the soul stretches continually after a condition of freedom. God alone is the inciter and the guarantor of freedom. He is the only guarantor." End quote. The tiniest departure from the fundamental principle of liberty is the first sign of the lurking presence of evil. That's important. Let me say it again. The tiniest departure from the fundamental principle of liberty is the first sign of the lurking presence of evil. Chambers saw the soul of man continually striving for freedom, and that surely is one of the great drives of man, to be free from external restraint. Chambers said, "It was the death of the will which communism, with great cunning, always tries to induce in its victims. The death of the will, because in the will lies the man's own mind, his own desire for freedom, his own striving after God. For it is in God only that he can find freedom." Listen to this short break, and I'll be right back.
For a free CD of this radio program that you can share with friends and others, write or call this week only and request the program titled A Mask of Evil. Write to Born to Win, Post Office Box 560, White House, Texas 75791. Or call toll free 1-888-BIBLE-44 and tell us the call letters of this radio station.
The enemy knows all about this yearning in man for freedom. He knows that it's a part of our nature, it's a part of our drive. So consequently, the enemy attempts to exploit this. Do you remember the sexual liberation movements of the 1960s? How everybody wanted to be free? It's funny how things stay the same over time. The great Apostle Peter wrote in the late first century of men he called spots and blemishes, having eyes full of adultery, that cannot cease from sin, enticing unstable souls. And he went on to say of these men, this is in 2 Peter chapter 2, "For when they speak great swelling words of vanity, they allure through the lusts of the flesh, through lewdness, the ones who have actually escaped from those who live in error. While they promise them liberty, they themselves are slaves of corruption. For by whom a person is overcome, by him also he is brought into bondage." From the great 1960s wave of sexual liberation comes bondage to corruption. Has the promise of sexual liberation been realized anywhere? You tell me what the fruits have been. I will tell you that one of its fruits is 50 million dead infants. You may call them fetuses, but they had developing arms and legs. They had faces. They had fingers. They had thumbs they could suck. They had eyes. They had ears. They had a brain. They even had an identity. They were written in God's book. Do you realize that the numbers of aborted children in this country compare with the millions killed by Stalin, whom we condemn as a monster? No generation has ever seen a clearer example of what Peter was talking about. And what can easily be lost is this: while they promise them liberty, understand this, promises not kept are another sign, one of the very opening signs, a very faint echo at the beginning, but it's there, of impending evil. Oh, I know, politicians are always making promises they have no intention of keeping. We listen to them, we blink our eyes, we turn away, we decide, oh, well, he won't do that anyway. Do we have to accept that? Can we not say every promise not kept is a lie? Now, what keeps it from being a lie? Well, if the person really intended to do the promise, if he really meant it, if it came from the heart, and he knows he can't do it, what does he do? He admits it. He apologizes. He said, "I know I promised, but I can't do it." So in the absence of that, a promise not kept is a lie. And you and I have every reason to ask, why should we trust a liar? Why do they lie? Because in their mind, they are gods, and their vision justifies the lie. The good we are going to do is so great, the things we are trying to accomplish are so justified, that even acts of terror are permitted. The revolutionary heart of communism is not the theatrical appeal, "Workers of the World Unite," Chambers wrote. "You have nothing to lose but your chains. You have a world to gain." It is a simple statement of Karl Marx, further clarified for handy use. Philosophers have explained the world. It is necessary to change the world. Kind of, that got to me a little bit, because all through the campaign of 2008, I kept asking myself, when people kept saying, change, 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 I said, change what? And here, in communism, I find the statement, philosophers have explained the world, it is necessary to change the world, and nobody says what for. Communists are bound together, he said, by no secret oath. The tie that binds them across the frontiers of nations, barriers of languages, differences of class, education, in defiance of religion, morality, truth, law, honor, the weakness of the body, the resolution of the mind, even unto death, is a simple conviction. It is necessary to change the world. Their power, whose nature baffles the rest of the world, because in a large measure the rest of the world has lost that power. It is the power to hold convictions and act on them. We have taken the freedom of religion clause in the Constitution to mean freedom from religion in this country, and this liberty from religion leads inevitably to corruption. Our school system, our universities are becoming increasingly godless. Chambers wrote, "Political freedom, as the Western world has known it, is only a political reading of the Bible. Religion and freedom are indivisible. Without freedom, the soul dies. Without the soul, there is no justification for freedom. Necessity is the only ultimate justification known to the mind. Hence, every sincere break with communism is a religious experience, though the communist fails to identify its true nature. A communist breaks because he must choose at last between irreconcilable opposites, God or man, freedom or communism." And strange as it may sound, the first time this choice was faced and made was in the Garden of Eden, when Adam and Eve chose their own minds over God. Until next time.
You have heard Ronald L. Dart. If you would like more information, or if you have any questions, write to Born to Win, Post Office Box 560, White House, Texas 75791. In the U.S. and Canada, call toll-free 1-888-BIBLE-44. And visit our website at borntowin.net.